This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden unveiled a $1.9 trillion coronavirus response plan Thursday evening, emphasizing the urgency of passing legislation to help Americans through the pandemic and the economic crisis it has brought. Biden's plan includes a new round of direct payments of $1,400 for most Americans, funding to promote the safe opening of schools, and mounting a national vaccine program. Also included is a $400 a week additional unemployment insurance through September, providing relief to small businesses, notably those owned by entrepreneurs of color, was also detailed in the plan. The aid package comes at a time when more than 23 million Americans have been infected with the coronavirus and more than 388,000 people have died from COVID-19 here in the United States. Well, authorities in Washington and around the nation are bracing for possible violence tied to the inauguration coming up on Wednesday. With less than a week before the inauguration day, federal authorities are on high alert. Law enforcement authorities say they are confident of maintaining safety during the event, despite warnings about further violence. Some 21,000 National Guardsmen will be backed by hundreds of federal agents and local and state police officers. 4 years ago, the Guard deployed some 8,000 soldiers for President Trump's inauguration. After a briefing on the inauguration security by top officials, Vice President Mike Pence said the ability of law enforcement agencies to protect dozens and dozens of events in Washington in the past gives great encouragement to us and to any American that will be looking on. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. A magnitude 6.2 earthquake erupted in Indonesia's Sulawesi Island Friday, killing at least 7 people and injuring hundreds, the country's disaster mitigation agency said. As panicked residents fled to safer areas, buildings were seen damaged. The quake was felt strongly for about 7 seconds, but did not trigger a tsunami warning. Vote counting is underway in Uganda's presidential and parliamentary elections. Voters had turned out in force Thursday, which pitted longtime leader Yoweri Museveni against the popular singer and lawmaker Bobi Wine, who is channeling the anger of many young Ugandans who say the former guerrilla leader Museveni, now 76, is out of touch, failing to tackle unemployment, corruption, and the surging public debt. Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, calls Wine an upstart backed by foreign governments and says his administration guarantees stability and progress, including much-needed hydropower dams and roads. The results of the election are expected in 2 days. A World Health Organization team of experts investigating the origins of the coronavirus are in Wuhan, China. It's been a year since the first reports of the disease emerged in Wuhan. The international team of scientists was supposed to arrive a month ago, but was delayed by the Chinese government, which drew a rare public criticism of Beijing from the WHO at the time. Beijing said the delay was a misunderstanding. The United States has also criticized the terms of the visit, under which Chinese experts have done the first phase of research. Washington has long accused Beijing a lack of transparency and hiding the extent of the initial outbreak. Well, the head of the World Food Program appealed to the Trump administration Thursday to reverse its decision designating a Yemeni rebel group as a terrorist entity, saying millions would slide into famine in the war-torn country as a result because food imports would shrink. The World Food Program chief, an American who was nominated to his UN post by President Trump, said the designation is literally going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also, additional news on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting is underway in Thursday's Uganda presidential election.
The counting advances in the Senate, and we know that the processes of transmitting the results are going on. We have officially opened the ballot center here in Kampala to start receiving the results.
Malawian migrant workers returning from South Africa riot in quarantine. A Kenyan puppeteer is pulling the strings to educate children about COVID-19. Many African countries put in place the national adaptation plans to mitigate climate change, and separatists blame Cameroon's military for what they call massacre at Mawutu.
On Sunday, January the 12th, early in the morning, French Cameroon soldiers descended on the Mawutu in the southern Cameroon's Ambazonia, and they slaughtered 11 people, including men, women, and children.
And a warning about human-induced climate change. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's posts are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Has begun in Thursday's Uganda presidential and parliamentary elections. Police raided a hotel where authorities say civil society activists have set up a parallel tally center. Voting day was also marred by a shutdown of all social media networks and messaging applications ordered by the country's Communication Commission. 76-year-old incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, in power for 35 years, is seeking another five-year term. His main challenger is 38-year-old Member of Parliament Rabo Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobby Wine. On the line from Kampala is Paul Bukenya, spokesperson for the Uganda Electoral Commission. Good morning, Paul. Welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Good morning to you, and I'm glad to be on the Voice of America.
Thank you, Paul. How did voting go on Thursday?
Well, we finished voting, first of all, and we're getting reports about how it has gone around the country, and the general picture is that it has gone well. We've not had incidences that have enabled voting to go ahead at the polling stations, and we have 34,684 polling stations. So far the reports show that all the polling stations received materials and were able to start, and now we're looking at how they finished.
We understand you have begun counting the ballots.
Yes, we've started counting the ballots at polling stations. That starts at 4 p.m. We know that turnout was high in most places that have been reporting, but certainly by now the counting at polling stations have started, and we know that the processes of transmitting the results are going on. We have officially opened the ballot center here in Kampala to start receiving the results.
The opposition groups have set up their own independent tallying centers. What can you tell us about this?
As a commission, we gave opportunity to candidates to be present at our national elections results tally center. But of course, we know that candidates get results from our polling stations because they have agents. So we guided them that the responsibility of tallying results and declaring a winning candidate lie with the Electoral Commission. While they may know and put together their performance, they cannot declare final results. So they have more collection centers than not tally centers, because the tally center remains the mandate of the Electoral Commission.
So what can you tell us about this report that police have raided this independent tally station? Do you know about that?
I'm not at this moment aware of that. Yes, I'm not aware of that.
What do you think was the impact of the ban on the social media platforms? Did that have any impact on the turnout?
Well, I do not think, because mobilization was done over so many months, and there's been high turnout of voting population. So we don't think that that has affected at all the turnout of voters. No, we don't think so.
So, Paul, when do you think you will announce preliminary results?
We expect the results to start coming in, and as they come in, we'll be making the announcement, because at this time we can only do partial results. So we are here throughout the night. As and when results start coming in, we will be announcing them. And then, by law, we're supposed to declare the final results in 48 hours after the closure of polls. So the time we have stretches and goes up to Saturday, 4 p.m. in the evening, when we must have declared the results of the election.
From the standpoint of the commission, Paul, do you think you have done enough to ensure that the elections will be free and fair?
I think we've done enough to achieve that. And now We are looking at the elections taking place because we still have elections along the way. I think we've done our part. We've made the program. We announced it on time. We mobilized stakeholders to participate. We nominated candidates. We have addressed issues that have been coming up during the exercise. And I think we're working within our mandate. We've delivered what's expected of us.
Paul, thank you very much. It's always nice to talk with you.
Welcome.
Paul Bukenya is the spokesperson for Uganda's Electoral Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. A spokesperson for the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia says the Cameroon military should be held responsible for the killing last Sunday of 10 people in the village of Mautu. The Cameroon military has acknowledged clashes at Mautu, but said reports that its troops killed civilians were not true. The United Nations and the European Union have both called for an investigation into the attack. In another development, the separatists have reiterated their threat to stop the African Nations Champions Soccer Tournament, which opens tomorrow Saturday in Cameroon. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia.
On Sunday, January the 12th, early in the morning, while people were still sleeping, French Cameroon soldiers descended on Mautu. Mautu is a little community in Fako County in the southern Cameroon's Ambazonia, and they slaughtered 11 people, including men, women, and children, while they were sleeping. The army, first of all, denied the massacres. But eventually, I guess owing to pressure, they admitted that somehow their soldiers went into the vicinity. But they have not yet fully admitted the soldiers carried out the massacres. That is the problem.
As you know, the Cameroon military denied that they carried out the so-called massacre.
Well, that is what they do all the time, James. When they went to Ngarebo and killed about 2 dozen people, they denied. But when pressure, when the evidence was unrefutable, they turned around and accepted it. Now, in the situation in Mautu, they are now arresting the victims and intimidating them from disclosing any information that they saw Cameroon soldiers at the scene. In fact, some of the victims are telling us that they are being told at the county or community attorney's office, they are being threatened from saying anything. If should they say anything, the narrative should be that Ambazonian forces were there in the scene, and that is why Cameroon soldiers came to the scene. This is what the victims are being intimidated to put out. So eventually, it is coming out very, very clear that these heinous genocides are carried out by French Cameroon soldiers. At the same day in Kumba with the school children, as in Ngarebo also.
The Nations Cup, which is taking place in Cameroon, is supposed to get underway on Saturday, the 16th. You have said that Ambazonia forces will disrupt the Nations Cup. Is that still the case?
James, we are not disrupting the Nations Cup. We have banned the Nations Cups in our country, the southern Cameroon's Ambazonia. French Cameroon can host all the cups in their territory. That is okay with us. But in the southern Cameroons, we have said no, that COP is not taking place. And if they venture stepping into that territory, somebody will die. And I really mean it, somebody will die. We have banned any foreign players, any foreign officials, any foreign football team setting foot on the territory that is called the southern Cameroons. And we have also declared a total lockdown of that county, Paco, during the scheduled period for that tournament. And so we are still warning. We are warning the Zambians. We are warning Namibians, warning Guinea, warning Tanzanians, warning Rwandans from setting foot in a war zone in which people are being slaughtered on a daily basis.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas.
Malawi is struggling to quarantine migrant workers returning from South Africa who were being tested for the coronavirus. At a facility this week, returnees upset over living conditions clashed with police, and authorities say about 20 returnees escaped. Lamek Masina reports.
After working in South Africa for 5 years, migrant rebel Groli Gahira was forced to return to Malawi after losing her job amid the pandemic. She says as foreigners, we were living in rented houses. We were supposed to buy food on our own, but we could not manage that. Gahira is one of about 600 Malawians who returned on Saturday and were quarantined at Mabanga Prison Training School. The facility was set up to stop the importation of coronavirus cases. Migrants returning from South Africa account for 40% of Malawi's caseload, but returnees on Sunday torched buildings to protest the poor living conditions. Police used tear gas to end the riot. Some returnees say authorities did not inform them they were going to be quarantined. Isaac Chikadza is one of them. He says we slept on the floor. Mattresses were in short supply. He says the food was good, but the hospitality they received did not meet their expectations. Officials say all returnees were informed on the quarantine and allege that some may have been seeking to avoid paying taxes. More than 150 of those being head tested positive for the coronavirus and are being isolated. Benjani Chunda is the government's environmental health officer.
These people will go home under escort, so they will not be missed out in the community. And then they will be handed over directly to the respective district health office.
Malawian authorities are searching for 20 returnees not yet tested who escaped during the Sunday's revolt. Major Emmanuel Nzima is the deputy commissioner for prisons.
I think it will be simple because immigration authorities have their passports. So it's just there to check on and see who is missing.
Meanwhile, 39 other returnees were arrested and charged with planning the scuffle. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Friday, January 15th. In a drive to educate people about COVID-19, a man in Kenya can be found pulling the strings. Puppeteer Michael Mutai uses his craft to entertain and teach kids about the dangers of the virus and is gaining quite a following. Victoria Amoga reports from Nairobi.
My name is Paula. Oh, I'm just about to go on set. So follow me.
41-year-old Kenyan Michael Mutahi is putting his 2 decades of puppeteering skills to use for educating kids about COVID-19. He records his puppet shows in front of a small audience and shares the video online.
It's hand washing, keep distance. Everyone was actually saying the same thing. But I look at myself and ask myself, I'm a writer. I'm a puppeteer. I can edit. I can do all these things. So I think I can come up with something more creative because guys are so bored at home and they need information and also, they also need to be entertained.
Kenya has close to 100,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 1,700 deaths. Mutahi's grandma and grandpa puppets, known as Kuhu and Babu in Swahili, teach coronavirus prevention in his growing audience. Nairobi resident Steve Maina watched a recent taping of the show.
For kids, it's better because kids would like more fun. It would draw their attention. When they're watching puppetry, it draws their attention for the young age.
Mutahi is among 100 professional puppeteers in Kenya. Director of Kenya's Institute of Puppet Theatre, Philemon Okoth, says they're doing more than just entertaining.
We have managed also to play a role in creating awareness in the community in relation to COVID-19. And we have several clips out there, not only from KPT, but also from partner organizations that we've trained that actually we coordinate most of their work, and also from individuals.
Kenyan authorities are supporting the use of puppets for COVID-19 education. Ezekiel Mtua is the chief executive officer of Kenya Film Classification Board.
We take the art to them. More importantly, because of COVID-19, right now the idea of having closed door theater is not very popular because you are limited because of social distancing. So this cinema, mobile cinema unit will become very popular.
For Mutahi, the merging of COVID prevention, teaching and puppetry means his art will also reach an even larger audience in Kenya. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Many African countries have put in place national adaptation plans to mitigate climate change. The United Nations Environment Programme announced yesterday, Thursday, that financing needs to increase for these plans. Richard Monang, Africa Regional Climate Change Coordinator for UNEP, spoke to Ricky Stryat about the details of these plans and the hurdles to implementing them.
When you put it within the context of Africa, Africa actually is at the forefront of suffering climate impacts. Firstly, because of socio-economic. When you look at the continent's socio-economic development is anchored around agriculture, which employs 65% of the entire workforce. At the same time, the agricultural production in the continent is rent-fed. And so because of the changing patterns altered by the changing climate, the agricultural sector is going to face actually one of the worst impacts and cause the continent not only to suffer food insecurity, but at the same time have huge impact when it comes to economic growth, because 32% of the GDPs are actually anchored to the agricultural production.
According to UNEP, 72% of countries have adopted at least one national level adaptation planning instrument. Is that number 72% of sub-Saharan African countries or global countries? What is the hurdle in putting these plans in place?
The beauty is that when it comes to plan strategies and policy, the African continent is doing excellent. The adaptation plans are all captured within their national determined contributions, which are anchored under the Paris Climate Change Agreement. And as we speak today, over 95% of African countries have ratified the Paris Climate Change Agreement. But the biggest challenge is turning those plans into reality, into action, because of lack of finance. Because of lack of finance most of the time, and also because of lack of knowledge and scientific knowledge, these have actually contributed to not just being a bottleneck, but at the same time constricted and restricted adaptation to be taken at a pace in which it's supposed to be given the vulnerability status of the continent. But the bigger question should be more about how can that pocket of successes leveraging on ecosystem-based adaptation that have showcased to not only provide resilience, but also showcase that actually adaptation is one of the best business opportunities, because adaptation is an investment opportunity, not only environmentally, socially, but also economically, and can provide dividends.
UNEP encourages nature-based solutions for adaptation. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what some of these solutions might look like? And are there any specific examples on the ground in some sub-Saharan Africa that you think should be held up as the way forward?
Yes, there are a lot of actions, nature-based solutions that are happening. Whether we're talking about agroforestry that have been practiced for over decades in the continent by farmers in communities, interspersing crop growth with trees that not only help to rejuvenate soil fertility, but at the same time also rejuvenate water retention capability, resulting to bumper harvest. Or whether we're talking about conservation agriculture, which actually is a simple approach of low soil, no soil tillage, or we're talking about organic manure, which is actually what is also called by fertilizer, turning agricultural waste.
That was Richard Moanak, Africa Regional Climate Change Coordinator for UNEP. He was speaking to Ricky Stryag from Nairobi, Kenya. The World Meteorological Organization says record-setting global temperatures are accelerating the pace of human-induced climate change. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Global data show 2020 was one of the three warmest years on record, closely rivaling 2016, which narrowly holds the top spot. The World Meteorological Organization says the past decade was the warmest on record, encompassing six of the world's hottest years. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis tells VOA the record-setting temperature events indicate a persistent long-term climate change trend.
The meaning of having all these very hot years is that it's a clear signal that climate change is continuing. There's no sign of it easing off at all, quite the contrary. So climate change is real. It's not a future scenario. It's happening now, and it's not going to go away, unfortunately, anytime soon.
Meteorologists say the Earth is 1.2 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels. At this rate, they warn, temperatures could rise by 3 to 5 degrees Celsius this century, which they say would be catastrophic. Temperature is just one of the indicators of climate change. The underlying cause is high levels of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Nulla says global warming has resulted in unprecedented extreme weather events in every region of the world, among them sustained heat and wildfires in Siberia.
We're seeing the melting of Arctic sea ice, the retreat of glaciers. These are contributing to accelerating sea level rise, which in turn has a knock-on effect that when we see, you know, extreme events like hurricanes, the impacts of those hurricanes are bigger because sea levels are higher.
The WMO says La Nina, a naturally occurring cooling climate phenomenon, put a brake on 2020's record-setting heat at the end of the year. La Nina is expected to continue into the early to mid part of this year. However, meteorologists note La Nina's cooling effect is only temporary. They say Britain's Met Office annual global temperature forecast suggests 2021 is likely to be one of Earth's hottest years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the rescheduled CHAN 2020. Cameroon is now ready to host the Total African Nations Championship, CHAN 2020, which is a competition organized for players playing in their domestic leagues across Africa. It kicks off on Saturday, January 16th, 2021. The competition was initially set to be held in April 2020, but was shifted to the 16th of January 2021 by the Confederation of African Football as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. A total of 16 teams are spread across four groups and will be competing for the top honors. Group A will have Cameroon, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Zimbabwe battling for the top two spots for the quarterfinals, while Libya, Niger, DR Congo, and Congo are in Group B. Morocco, Rwanda, Togo, and Uganda are in Group C, while Group D will have the likes of Zambia, Guinea, Namibia, and Tanzania. Football giants like Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, and Tunisia all failed to qualify for this year's tournament. Some of the coaches have been speaking on their expectations ahead of the tournament. Jonathan McKinstry is Uganda Cranes head coach.
Expectation after the Mini-CHAN tournament is really to have our players in the best possible position to start CHAN itself. It's a great opportunity to acclimatize to the conditions here in Cameroon. Yeah, it's a great preparation for us. We're playing against difficult opponents.
For his part, Zambia coach Milton Mitchell Sredatovich is confident that his squad has the capacity to progress from the group stages of the tournament.
I'm happy with the squad we are having. We have touch of experience from some players. Rest of the teams, I believe we have the best of the best, and we have what it takes to enter in competition, pass the group, and then from first match to look every match as a cup final.
Away from the CHAN 2020 now to weightlifting, where Nigeria will participate in the African Weightlifting Championships slated for April 1 to April 8th at Vakaus in Mauritius. Christopher Nwadi, the technical director of the Nigerian Weightlifting Federation, confirmed that the tournament will serve as an Olympic qualifier. Eight weightlifters, six female and two males, will represent the country at the championships. And finally, Chelsea and Cote d'Ivoire legend Didier Drogba has revealed that his 10-year marriage with his Malian wife, Lala Dekati, is over after appearing in an intimate video in bed with a mystery woman. Drogba, who is now 42 years old, met Diakate in the late 1990s in Paris and they married in 2011. Drogba enjoyed two spells at Chelsea, winning several titles, including four Premier League titles and the Champions League in 2012. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, January 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.